December 21st marks the one-year anniversary of a very important celestial event, the Great Mutation. The alignment of the planets Saturn and Jupiter in the sky, marking a return of Saturn's rule in the heavens and the official beginning of the Age of Aquarius. According to some, the dawning of a new golden age. A new golden age for whom, exactly? For worshippers of Saturn? Who is Saturn? It turns out this Roman god Saturn has gone by many names throughout history. Kronos, Baal, Molech, El. He was worshipped by ancient Mesopotamians and the Ammonites. The Philistine giants of David's day worshipped the sons of Saturn. Saturn's name was changed to Molech, and he demanded child sacrifices. In all his forms, Saturn has been connected to the underworld. So, what does the re-emergence of Saturn mean for mankind? Derek Gilbert, author of The Second Coming of Saturn, The Great Conjunction, America's Temple, and The Return of the Watchers, is next on Coast to Coast AM. Derek P. Gilbert hosts the news analysis program 5 in 10 for Skywatch TV and co-hosts the weekly video programs The Bible's Greatest Mysteries and Unraveling Revelation with his wife, author, and analyst Sharon K. Gilbert. Derek's the author of the groundbreaking books Bad Moon Rising, The Great Inception, and Last Clash of the Titans. He's also the co-author with Sharon of Veneration, a study of the Mesopotamian cult of the dead, and Giants, Gods, and Dragons, a fresh take on end times prophecy that identifies the entities traditionally called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And the brand new one is The Second Coming of Saturn, The Great Conjunction, America's Temple, and The Return of the Watchmen. Derek, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you?
I'm doing well, Richard. Thank you for having me. It's always always enjoyable talking with you.
Likewise. Thank you. So we're just approaching the one-year anniversary of this astrological conjunction called the Great Mutation. So what did it look like in the sky? Would we have noticed anything different a year ago?
Well, it was in the news. It was called the Christmas Star, and this is because this is the closest observable conjunction between Jupiter and Saturn since the year 1226. They met very close together in the sky at 0 degrees of the constellation Aquarius. Now, it wasn't the Christmas Star. The Christmas Star is a little more spectacular than that. In the night sky here in the Ozarks, well, we don't have a lot of light pollution. It was interesting because you saw these two bright points of light in the sky, but it wasn't anything spectacular. It wouldn't have been enough to put me on a camel and cross a desert for 4 months. But the significance to astrologers and New Agers is that they believe this signals a move to a new phase of reality. Aquarius is ruled by the planet Saturn, they believe. And just full disclosure, as a Christian, I do not believe that our fortunes, our fates are determined by the movement of the planets in the sky at night. But there are influential people who believe that they are. And that's the relevance here.
Right.
Saturn and this transition from Jupiter, who was the king of the Roman pantheon, he was the king of the gods, equated with Zeus of the Greeks, Baal of the Canaanites, and a number of other storm gods in the ancient world. This was essentially a transfer of power back to his father, Saturn of the Romans, Kronos of the Greeks, El of the Canaanites, and a number of other names that I spell out in the book, and his return from the netherworld. And the reason is that the Roman poet Virgil, about the year 40 BC, wrote a poem called the Fourth Eclogue, in which he prophesied, or at least it's interpreted as a prophecy, of the return of the golden age over which Saturn, Kronos, et cetera, ruled at some point in the distant past, and that this new golden age would mean, according to these modern astrologers and New Agers, a life that more prosperous. We'll be less materialistic, and power will be decentralized. And I suggest that looks a lot like the Great Reset that the World Economic Forum has been promoting. And I don't think it's a coincidence that a month after the Great Conjunction, or the Great Mutation, as the astrologers call it, the World Economic Forum rolled out its plan for a more decentralized, less materialistic world.
Right. You'll own nothing and be happy.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, when you talk about the Age of Aquarius, Derek, I remember, you know, that song by the Fifth Dimension, The Dawning of the Age of Aquarius. That came out like back in the late 60s, I think. People tend to equate the late 60s with the Age of Aquarius, but you're saying officially we didn't enter into the Age of Aquarius until like 1 year ago.
The winter solstice of 2020, that was the significance of that event in the sky. The so-called Christmas star, this great conjunction, marked the official full entry into the Age of Aquarius. And again, the significance being that Aquarius is ruled by Saturn. So they believe things are a-changing, and this is the beginning of that new golden age that Virgil called for 2,000 years ago.
So when you talk about the second coming of Saturn, you're not just speaking astrologically here. Do you believe that Saturn, the god that was worshipped by the Mesopotamians and the Romans, was real, an actual entity?
Well, that was certainly the understanding of the early Christians. The early church understood that the gods of their pagan neighbors were fallen angels. I mean, as Christians, this is not what we've been taught, but if we accept the existence of Satan, which is not a sure thing among today's Christian church, but about roughly half of American Christians accept that Satan is a literal entity, then we need to consider the possibility that there are other fallen angels out there who masqueraded as gods to the pagan neighbors of ancient Israel. Well, when we read the Bible carefully, this was the understanding of the Hebrew prophets, the apostles, and the early Christian church. Baal was real, Zeus was real, Jupiter was real, et cetera, et cetera, but they were just fallen angels, and in some cases, demons. The Apostle Paul wrote that what the pagans sacrificed to idols, they were actually sacrificing to demons. Saturn is known by many names, and in the book, The Second Coming of Saturn, I argue that his earliest known identity is Shemeyaza, who was named in the book of First Enoch as the leader of a rebellion, which is just very briefly mentioned in the Bible in Genesis chapter 6. And I argue that at the end, he escapes his punishment. If you know the story of Saturn or Cronos or the Greeks, you know that when he was deposed by his son, the storm god, Zeus, Jupiter, he was cast down to Tartarus and confined there. Well, the Bible tells us there are angels confined in Tartarus for bad behavior, but they get out in Revelation chapter 9. And I argue that this chief of the watchers, Shemeyaza, is the king over those in the pit called the destroyer, Apollyon in Greek and Abaddon in Hebrew.
So Shemeyaza was what? The chief fallen angel that when they descended to Mount Hermon, and in Genesis 6 it talks about the fallen angels taking the wives of or the daughters of men, so human women, commingling with them, producing hybrids, the Nephilim. So the chief fallen angel that landed at Mount Hermon, that's Saturn. That's the same person, or it's not the same person, the same entity.
Correct. That's my theory anyway, and I think the evidence supports that.
And then, so he is worshipped by various tribes in Canaan, and I guess before that, even Mesopotamia. How do we know that it's, so for example, the god that was worshipped by the Mesopotamians in Urkesh, and the god that was worshipped by the Philistines, the giants of David's day. How do we know that they're all the same entity?
Thankfully, archaeologists and epigraphers, those who study ancient languages and these ancient texts, have deciphered many of those clay tablets that have come out of the ground in ancient Mesopotamia, what today is Iraq and Syria and Israel and Turkey and Iran and Egypt, and found that as these cultures came into contact with each other, the Akkadians and the Sumerians and the Hurrians and the Hittites and the Mycenaean Greeks and so forth, they had to create, the scribes, the class that knew how to read and write, had to create multilingual word lists. And since religion, there was no separation of church and state back in the day. So religion was a central part of their lives. And so understanding whose gods corresponded to whose was important. And so we've got enough of these god lists that, okay, the Akkadians call him Enlil, and the Hurrians call him Kumarbi, and the Amorites call him El. Okay, so we got that set. Okay, and over here in along the Euphrates River, he's Dagon, and down here he's the chief god of the Assyrians, Asher. So by piecing together these texts and looking at these essentially interlocking ancient texts, we can figure out that this entity occupied the same spot in the pantheon, which is the other bit of evidence here. The stories are similar enough that you can detect the same thread connecting all of these stories together. And so by so doing, you can trace the career, if you will, of the Roman god Saturn all the way back to 4000 BC or thereabouts in northern Mesopotamia.
And what form did that worship to this god Saturn take? Did it involve human sacrifice, child sacrifice from the beginning, or did it evolve, or I should say devolve into that?
It seemed to devolve into that. The earliest identity that we've got evidence for is the Hurrian god Kumarbi. And the Hurrians occupied what would be the Kurdish territories of northern Mesopotamia today. So the border between modern Iraq and Turkey, northern Syria and Turkey, that's kind of the homeland of the ancient Hurrians. Their point of origin appears to be the area just below the Caucasus Mountains in modern Armenia. But the oldest city, you mentioned this just a few minutes ago, the city Urkesh, well known to be a sacred city, or the earliest known city founded by the Hurrian people. And the worship of their chief god, Kumarbi, appears to have revolved around a ritual pit that was shaped like a keyhole, but it goes down about 40 feet, according to the archaeologists who've excavated there. This site is in northeastern Syria, very close to the border with Turkey, and they date it back to about 3500 BC. So at the same time, the ancient Sumerians were building their cities like Ur and Uruk and Eridu. In northern Mesopotamia, the Hurrians were building their city, Urkesh, and the temples look very, very similar. But this ritual practice, and the archaeologists have been able to piece this together from texts that have been preserved by the ancient Hittites. 2,000 years later, around the time of the Judges in the biblical period, preserving these ancient Hurrian rituals where they would descend into this pit, offer up a sacrificial animal, a lamb, a piglet, a puppy sometimes, and summon entities from the netherworld. But as time went on, and we saw different identities worn by this entity with different cultures, like the Ammonites, who called him Milcom, the Hebrews referred to as Molech, Baal Haman of the Phoenicians of the classical period, Kronos of the Greeks, Saturn of the Romans. Yes, child sacrifice became part of the ritual. And early Christian apologists said, well, it's no wonder, because when you know the story of Saturn or Kronos, the myth was that they had been warned that because they had overthrown their father, the sky god, they would be deposed by their children. And so to prevent this, Kronos, Saturn, Baal Haman ate their children as they were born. And so early Christian apologists said, well, no wonder. He didn't spare his own children, so why would he not demand that his followers sacrifice theirs?
You mentioned the Hurrian territory in northern Mesopotamia. That's where Abraham came from. Is his leaving Mesopotamia? Is that at all connected with the worship of Saturn?
Well, I think it is. And again, in northern Mesopotamia, that entity would have been known as Kumarbi, but as Abraham left and went into Canaan, he would have encountered the same entity by the names Dagon and then El of the Canaanites. There are some scholars who suggested that Urkesh was the actual title of the city referred to in the book of Genesis as Ur of the Chaldees or Ur of the Chaldeans. In Hebrew, that's Ur Kasdim, but it's possible it may have been Urkesh. There's another candidate that's in that area named called Ura, a scholar about 60 years ago named Cyrus Gordon wrote a paper arguing for a northern Mesopotamian point of origin for Abraham rather than southeast Mesopotamia. In fact, it wasn't until 1922 when the ancient Sumerian city of Ur in what is now southeast Iraq was found by Sir Leonard Woolley. Nobody thought that Abraham came from southeast Iraq. Everybody assumed it was northern Mesopotamia. And there's other evidence. Abraham's lifestyle as a sort of a pastoralist, a nomad, wandering around with his herds and flocks, that's more consistent with the northern Mesopotamian Amorite lifestyle or Hurrian lifestyle than southeast Iraq, which is than Sumer, rather, which was city-based. But it's possible that the reason that Abraham, when he sent his servant back to his home territory to find a wife for his son Isaac, may have wanted to keep his son away from that worship. He said, "You must not take my son back there." So, but yeah, I think northern Mesopotamia was his point of origin. And certainly in the book, I show how that worship, that practice of summoning entities from the netherworld shows up in the Bible.
What about the connection between the Hurrians and King David in the Bible?
David is became the king at the city of Hebron, and then 7 years later, he and his men took the city of the Jebusites. And it is known by scholars that later, as David commands that a census be taken of his people, God decides to punish David for that because he's acting like the kings of the pagans and ruling over his people instead of ruling as a sort of a priest king. He has disobeyed God, and so God sends a destroying angel to smite the people. And David and the angel appears over Jerusalem, and so David goes to a high place on Mount Moriah and buys the threshing floor of Araunah, or Ornan, depending on which book of the Old Testament you're reading the story in. It's recorded in 2 Samuel and also 1 Chronicles. That word, Araunah, is derived from the Hurrian word for Lord. So there are scholars who believe that the Jebusites were just a sub-tribe or a tribe of the Hurrians, and that Araunah was the king of the Jebusites who David allowed to live after they took the city. So the Hurrians were there, and there were other Hurrians mentioned in the Old Testament as well. I touch on that in the book because, again, the influence of this people called the Hurrians and the fact that we can trace them back to what is now Armenia because of the proximity to where Noah and the Ark landed, I think is very significant.
All right, Derek, we'll take a quick timeout, come back. We'll dial back a little bit earlier in King David's life when he battled the Philistine giant Goliath. And this warrior group of giants who worshipped Saturn's sons. Derek P. Gilbert, the author of The Second Coming of Saturn, stays with us. Here's Hush by the Marias, the L.A. band named after the lead singer Mariah Zardoya, taking us into the break right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, the website strangeplanet.ca. Documents released recently under FOIA detail how several U.S. Navy destroyers were harassed repeatedly for weeks by swarms of mysterious drones. The incidents occurred during the summer of 2019 when at least three ships recorded clusters of unidentified aerial vehicles in their vicinity. The U.S. Navy has launched an investigation into the unexplained incidents, but at this time, no photos or explanations have been made public. You can read more about these swarms of drones harassing U.S. Navy destroyers in the highlight carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, more of my conversation with Derek P. Gilbert, the author of The Second Coming of Saturn, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Derek P. Gilbert, the author of The Second Coming of Saturn. So we were mentioning King David. And earlier, when David was just a boy, of course, the biblical story of his battle with Goliath. And you say that Goliath belonged to this warrior cult that worshiped the sons of Saturn. Tell me about that.
Well, The chief god of the Philistines was Dagon, who was just another identity worn by this entity. He occupied, again, the same spot in the pantheon. He was the creator god of their pantheon, but had been replaced as the king of the gods by the storm god. When we go back to the story of Shemaiah and the account in Genesis chapter 6, again, remembering that he led the rebellion that led to the creation of the Nephilim, it was the understanding of the Hebrew prophets in the early church that demons were the spirits of the Nephilim who had been destroyed in the flood. This is explicit. This is spelled out in the book of First Enoch. Not so much explicit in the Bible, but when you read the writings of the early church fathers, the early church theologians for the first four centuries after the resurrection of Jesus Christ understood that this was where demons came from. They connected them explicitly to the Greek, the old gods of the Greeks, the Titans, who they understood were fallen angels. So that's the backstory. Dagon is Shemaiah, and he was responsible for this rebellion that led to the creation of these hybrid spirits that still roam the earth as demonic entities. In 2 Samuel 21, toward the end of David's life, there's war against the Philistines. David leads his men out, and on the battlefield, he grows weary and almost gets himself killed. One of these giants is called Ishbi-Benob, B-E-N-O-B, and he described as one of the descendants of the giants. But the Hebrew term is Yeledei HaRapha. Now, scholars have wrestled with this because the word ha in Hebrew is the definite article, the. So descendants of the giants, but Rapha is not a plural, it's a singular. So what are we talking about here? And when you use the word descendant in English, it's assumed that you're meaning a literal genetic blood descendant. And a scholar by the name of Conrad LaRue showed some years ago that that word Yeledei does not mean a literal blood descendant. It means more properly someone who is initiated into a group. So like a servant of, but to somebody who's initiated into this group. So he argued that these Philistine giants, whether they were exceptionally tall or not, and I mentioned in the book that Goliath, according to the oldest Hebrew text, was only about 6'9", you know, 4 cubits in a span instead of what we see in our English Bible, 6 cubits in a span, which would be 9'9". Still, when you're an Israelite standing 5'4" on average, that's still pretty big. But more, I think more important to us is the spiritual connection here. These descendants of the giants, or servants of the giants, more likely were a cult that venerated the spirits of these ancient mighty men who were of old, a reference to the Nephilim of Genesis chapter 6. And as evidence, look back to the name Ishbi-Benob. If you split Ben and Ob, O-B, you actually get son of the Ov, and Ov is a word translated earlier in 2 Samuel as medium. The witch of Endor, or the medium of Endor, was the Ov of Endor, someone who summons these spirits, these demonic spirits, from the netherworld using a ritual pit. So I think we've got evidence there to make the case that Goliath and these other giants of the Philistines venerated these demonic spirits called Rephaim, who were the actual spirits of the Nephilim destroyed in the flood. It was a demonic warrior cult.
So just a quick aside then, Goliath and I guess the other Philistine giants at the time are not, they were just exceptionally tall. They're not necessarily descendants of the Nephilim. In other words, they're not descended from the hybridization of fallen angels and human women, or are they?
I argue, and Sharon and I argued in our previous book, Veneration, which dealt exclusively with this topic, that whether they were or they were not, we have no way of knowing. But since the Nephilim were destroyed in the flood, we argue that it's probable they were not. The important point is that they worshipped those spirits, and again, had preserved that. And we can, again, look at the religious practices of the pagans around ancient Israel, where the veneration of the dead and especially veneration of the dead kings of old, the mighty men of old, was a central part of the religion of the ancient Canaanites.
You also have some new information in the book concerning the sons of Saturn and his demonic children.
Well, yeah, again, this was something that we've been, a thread we've kind of been pulling on, research thread for the last few years, trying to figure out who exactly the Rephaim were, and did the neighbors of the ancient Israelites know who they were? They're mentioned by name only in the book of Genesis and Deuteronomy as the Israelites encountered tribes that were counted as Rephaim in the Transjordan. That's the area east of the Jordan River, the ancient kingdoms of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. But they're mentioned far more often than that in the Old Testament. It's just that English translators, or translators who translate the Hebrew into English, usually translate the word Rephaim into a word like the dead or the shades or the departed. And it's only been the last 40 years or so that scholars have translated enough texts from the pagans around ancient Israel to understand the context that those actually reference to these specific spirits among the dead who have special status among the dead, because these were believed to be these the spirits of the dead kings, the ancestral kings of the Amorites and the Canaanites, who had special status in the other world and were believed to have the power to intercede for the living in the land of the living. A scholar by the name of Amar Anus, he's from Estonia, about 20 years ago, published a paper titled, Are There Greek Rephaim? And he showed that the hero cults of the Greeks, the worship of demigods like Heracles and Perseus and Bellerophon and Cadmus, comes right from the ancient Canaanites and Amorites, that the term used by the Greek poets Hesiod and Homer to describe the men of the Golden Age when Kronos ruled in heaven derives from the same Semitic root word from which the Hebrews get the Rephaim.
Hmm. What about Ezekiel's wheel? We often, on this program, people make the connection between Ezekiel's wheel and a UFO being mentioned in the Bible. What's the connection between the god Saturn and Ezekiel's wheel?
That's a case of us reading our 21st century science fiction worldview back into the Bible. One of the other identities worn by this entity, Saturn Shemayaza, is Enlil, who is the chief god of Akkad and Sumer. And he was later replaced at the top of the pantheon by Marduk, who was the city god of Babylon when Babylon became the dominant political power around 1000 BC. Enlil was still considered the creator god of Mesopotamia, and the city that was sacred to Enlil, called Nippur, or sometimes Nibru, which, quite frankly, is where the late Zechariah Sitchin got the name Nibiru. It's just that he misinterpreted it as a planet somewhere out there in the edges of the solar system. No, it was Nippur. It was a city in what is now Iraq, where the temple of Enlil was located, and that's where it was believed the gods of Mesopotamia would come from their sacred cities and meet once a year to decree the fates of the land for the coming year. Well, in the 6th century BC, Ezekiel is shown a vision of the wheels within wheels, and our friend Dr. Michael Heiser, who's not only a renowned Bible scholar, he's also a respected ufologist, has shown that that imagery of a throne with wheels within wheels was common imagery for a royal throne in ancient Mesopotamia. This is not Ezekiel trying to make sense of advanced technology. This is what royal thrones looked like back in the ancient world. But he mentions that this vision took place over the Kevar Canal. It's spelled C-H-E-B-A-R, the Kevar Canal. And he mentions it five times in the book of Ezekiel. He keeps referring back to it. Well, I saw the vision at first over the Kevar Canal. What's the significance of the Kevar Canal? It ran right through the city of Nippur, which means that God revealed his royal throne, his heavenly throne in all its glory, with the throne guardians, the cherubim around him, directly over the temple of the chief god of the Mesopotamians, Enlil, who is Saturn, Kronos, Baal, Haman, Shemiyaza, etc. This was God basically saying, I am the true ruler of the universe.
Throwing down the gauntlet. Okay. So Lucifer, you say, is not Satan.
Correct. I'd always wondered about this. There are two chapters in the Old Testament that seem to describe, that do describe a rebellion in Eden for which the this rebel was punished and thrown out of Eden and thrown out of the garden, thrown off the mountain of God. That's Isaiah chapter 14, which is where we see the reference to Lucifer, and Ezekiel 28. But Isaiah 14 makes a number of references. This is one of those places where we see the shades or the Rephaim mentioned. You know, the Rephaim rise up to greet you when you land in Sheol, and they say, now you're as weak as we, and worms are your coverings and maggots are your bed, something to that effect. But when you read the Old Testament, Satan isn't mentioned very often, and when he is, it's clear that he's not in the underworld. In the book of Job, most notably, he's there with the other sons of God, which is a phrase, by the way, in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, that always refers to supernatural entities, not to humans. So he's there in the throne room of God and accusing Job. We also see it in Zechariah chapter 4, where he is accusing the high priest Joshua, who was the high priest of the Jews in the time of Zechariah and Zerubbabel. So he's not confined to the netherworld. So what's the connection there, and why the connection to the Rephaim, who, again, are the spirits of the Nephilim, since we don't see anything in the Old Testament that connects Satan to that Genesis 6 rebellion? When you read Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, parallel chapters, scholars agree they refer to the same event. There's nothing in there that connects that rebellion and that rebel to Adam and Eve. So I argue in the book that Lucifer, which is just a transliteration of the Latin rendering of the Hebrew name Helel ben Shakar, that this entity is someone else. And then a friend of ours, Dr. Doug Hamp, who's got an excellent new book, by the way, which I cite in The Second Coming of Saturn, called Corrupting the Image 2, pulled some new information out of a stone that was found in 1869 on the summit of Mount Hermon, the first new information in 100 years. Doug pointed me to a paper by a scholar named William Gallagher showing that the name, the Hebrew name, Helel ben Shakar, which roughly means lightbringer, son of the dawn, is how a Hebrew writer would have transliterated the Akkadian name of Enlil. So I argue that this Lucifer that we've been taught was Satan is actually this other entity who's confined in the abyss, Enlil, Saturn, Shemiyaza, waiting for the judgment when he gets out at the end in Revelation chapter 9.
So I'm a little confused. So are you saying that Lucifer is Saturn, or is Saturn Satan?
Saturn and Satan are two different entities. Satan is still wandering about. As in the New Testament, he still had freedom to roam about. He tempted Jesus in the wilderness. He's described as a lion prowling about seeking whom he may devour, whereas according to Peter and Jude, these entities who rebelled in Genesis 6 are in chains in gloomy darkness. In fact, 2 Peter 2:4 is Peter's specific. He says they're in Tartarus. The word translated hell in English is actually Tartarus in the Greek. They are separate entities. Satan, Saturn, two different entities, both with roles to play in the end times.
And so who was in the garden with Adam and Eve?
Garden, yeah. Well, you know, the Bible's not explicit on that. I'm willing to accept that that was Satan. But I think Saturn, Shemiyaza, was there as well. And in fact, when you read Ezekiel 28 carefully and you see the description of him as being covered by every type of precious jewel, those jewels are the same ones that are in the ephod of the high priest. So it's possible that this entity, Shemiyaza, Saturn, was the original high priest of God in the Garden of Eden.
So in the pecking order, who outranks who, Saturn or Satan?
That's a good question. I would argue that, at least in the book of Revelation, it appears that Satan is calling the shots. but it may not always have been that way. And these entities probably don't get along with each other. They are allied with each other in the rebellion against their creator, against God. But they're probably like, say, the Democrats when Donald Trump was in office. They all hated Trump, but then they're fighting with each other to see who's going to take his place.
All right. We'll pick this up on the other side as we approach the top of the hour. Derek P. Gilbert, the book is The Second Coming of Saturn. Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM.